Comedy Hour on your host, Bob Runyon, and tonight we will recall and review Frank Herbert, the author of Dunes, first published science fiction story in Astounding Science Fiction. And the story was originally entitled Nightmare Blues, and they retitled it Operation Syndrome later on. It came out in 1954 in Astounding. Now, this is an ominously prophetic and frightening tale of electronic mind control, which seems to have been inspired by the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. This was an old silent film from 1919 about a scientist who was in an insane asylum, and he had a stage hypnotist who was impersonating him and doing the carnival circuit and controlling a somnambulist in a coffin and sending him out to commit a series of murders. That was The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, German silent film, 1919. However, in Nightmare Blues, also has a scientist who ends up in a madhouse who invents a machine that projects thoughts, a telepathy transceiver, which is stolen by a music industry producer and promoter who uses it to enhance his star's vocal performances. However, each city where they perform experiences catastrophic outbreaks of mass insanity. And now one of the mad scientist's former students, a psychologist, teams up with a ham radio operator to create an antidote machine. Now, this story was, as I said, published in 1954, and it was supposed to take place in 1999. Now, it deals with issues and theories that resonate today. So, if you want to contemplate some high-tech horror for Halloween, tune in, stay with us, and we'll turn up the volume. Now, as our regular listeners know, we've been recently reviewing various works of prophetic science fiction published in the 20th century that have predicted conditions and situations now manifesting in the 21st century. We have reprised Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, which predicted the deterioration of American industry, George Orwell's 1984, which predicted the end of British and American freedom and dignity, Korbluth's The Marching Morons, which predicted the dumbing down of the American people, and Frank Herbert's Dune, which predicted the Arabian domination of world transportation and the present international terrorist jihad. Now, for Halloween this year, we would like to look back at another of Frank Herbert's prophetic tales, the 1954 story, Nightmare Blues. Now, to summarize the story, which is supposed to take place in 1919, the turn of the century, we open with a worldwide epidemic of violent outbreaks of mass insanity. Now, these are much like our zombie apocalypse films today. They occur in various cities around the world. People run amok in destructive riots, public suicides, and mass chaos. Honolulu, London, Karachi, and all around the world, the epidemic is called the syndrome. And no one knows the cause. So enter the hero or the protagonist. If hero seems too macho for you, protagonist is a little more politically correct these days. We'll talk about political correctness as a form of brainwashing in a little bit. And the psychologist, the hero, is an experimental psychologist who works with a telepathic machine called the teleprobe, invented by this scientist who ended up in the asylum. Now, our hero, Dr. Eric Ladd, is located in Seattle. And he works with a teleprobe in his practice with his clients. And this, of course, has influence on some other science fiction stories like Inception, the movie, and the Dream Masters. But this machine affects him as well as his patients. He dreams about a female singer singing a song called Insane Crazy Blues. He meets the vocalist herself, Colleen Lanai, on the street. This is too much of a coincidence, but I suppose if she's reaching him in a dream, and he's got the machine, then they could probably end up walking out in the same suite, meeting each other. Okay, and he discovers that her producer and a company, that kind of companyist, this Pete Sarantis, got the plans for the teleprobe from his old mentor in the asylum and built his own version of it, which he called the Musicron. Now, both these units operate with a bowl on the head. But with the Musicron, the operator sits inside a cabinet. Now, I said above that this story may have been inspired by the old silent horror film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, by Robert Winney in 1919. Caligari was also, the scientist, Dr. Caligari, was also in an asylum. And this stage hypnotist impersonated him on the carnival circuit. And the stage performer used a somnambulist under hypnosis in his act, and the somnambulist made predictions. But the somnambulist also went out like Dracula out of his cabinet and committed a series of murders. I also suspect that Herbert was influenced by Richard Shaver and his ancient electronic mind control machine stories, which were popular around the time Nightmare Blues was written. And now we might as well insert a plug for our midnight movie on this theme, Beyond Lemuria, second edition, and mention our own version of the teleprobe, Shaver's Telod, the Incogravitron. Now, we also might mention, around this time, in the 1950s, electronic music and music augmentation was just getting started, and jazz was embracing the technology. The theremin and synthesizers were being developed, and subliminal audio and visuals were being experimented with. Electronic mind control was in the incubator stage. To get on with the story, though, Dr. Eric retraces Colleen and Pete's world tour gig and realizes that after they perform in each city, the mass insanity syndrome breaks out. He uses the Jungian collective unconscious to theorize how the effect works. He suggests that the Musicron dislocates the consciousness point and suspends it as if on a long fishing line down into the deep subconscious where demonic forces can take control of the psyche. Of course, this confirms my previous conclusion that Frank Herbert was hermetic in his personal philosophy. Many of his works, including Dune, also confirm this. To make it a good story, Colleen finally realizes that she and Pete are causing the epidemic, and she leaves him for Eric. And she brings with her the evil Pete's plans for the music run. Now, Eric decides to build an anecdote version. Now, in trying to buy parts for his anecdote version, he acquires the help of Baldy Platt, a ham radio enthusiast, and they go to work building their anti-inferno machine. Now, this whole sequence is delightful. The original Musicron is similar to, and perhaps influenced by, Edward John Starmack, which John Hatfield Hart lifted for his Hidden World receiver in 1961. And if you want to see the plans for that, that's in the Seventh Ray, Book 3, The Green Ray, in 2011. Now, this was basically an ultra-high-frequency amplifier which picked up extraterrestrial or interterrestrial transmissions. It was originally a tube set, but Herbert's lab and Platt had the same problem that we had, that Dr. X and I had. The American electronics industry had gone over to transistors in the 1950s, away from tubes. And unless you could find Russian virgin commies, the only vacuum tubes available, you were just out of luck. But we built a working model of the StarMech with transistors, and Herbert's team built their Musicron in time to save the world from the nightmare blues. And, of course, the story does raise a lot of questions. How much did Herbert know about all of this in the 1950s? Was he simply inspired by Shaver, or did he have other sources? Now, Herbert had a scientific mind. You can tell that he knew electronics as you read the description of the Musicron's parts and circuitry. He was comfortable with the technical and psychological aspects of this tale. Could he have been predicting something already in development? Very possibly so. We all know the story of Lucille Ball's tooth. In 1941, the actress, Lucy, had some dental work that received Morse code signals. She rode with the FBI in an RDF van to an apartment in Hollywood where they arrested a Japanese Black Dragon clandestine radio operator. Now, if the Black Dragons could reach Lucy's tooth in 1941, what could the CIA or the KGB do in 1951? We should also recall the experimentation on sound frequencies and their psychological effects. You can go online, by the way, and experience the effects of some of these tonalities and rhythms if you want to, and they're kind of disturbing. Music itself has long been known to have deep and moving psychological effects. Magic, we are well aware of shamanic drumming and the effects of rhythm creating trance and visionary states which can affect our emotions. Perhaps more insidious is the entire subliminal technology, both audio and visual, which Congress tried to get under control in the 1950s. Along with this, the new semantic brainwashing discipline of neurolinguistics has created the art of sentient propaganda and carried it down to new depths. As an example of mass brainwashing, the mental syndrome of political correctness has been so effectively imposed upon the entire population that any breach of that diabolical ethic creates an immediate negative reaction, which can become a chain reaction, a political weapon of mass destruction. And at this point, having said that, I'm going to read an article on the origins and the theory behind political correctness, because this is a form of brainwashing. It's a form of brainwashing which has affected virtually all of us. And it's something that we, something that, quite frankly, as a magician, I think political correctness is one of the greatest dangers to our freedom of thought. And it is certainly brainwashing. Now, this is, and then what I want to read here is from discoverthenetworks.org, a guide to the political left. And it's called Political Correctness, Cultural Marxism. America today is dominated by a system of beliefs, attitudes, and values that we have come to know as political correctness. For many, it is an annoyance and a self-parodying joke. But political correctness is deadly serious in its aims, seeking to impose a uniformity of thought and behavior on all Americans. It is therefore totalitarian in nature. Its roots lie in a version of Marxism which sees culture, rather than the economy, as the site of class struggle. Under Marxist economic theory, the oppressed workers were supposed to be the beneficiaries of a social revolution that would place them on the top of the power structure. When these revolutionary opportunities presented themselves, however, the workers did not respond. The Marxist revolutionaries did not blame their theory for these failures. Instead, they blamed the ruling class, which had bought off the workers by giving them rights and had blinded them with a false consciousness that led them to support national governments and a liberal democracy. One group of Marxist intellectuals resolved this apparent contradiction of Marxist theory by an analysis that focused on society's cultural superstructure rather than on the economic base, as Marx did. The Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci and the Hungarian Marxist George Lukács contributed the most to this cultural Marxism. Among Marxists, Gramsci is noted for his history, for his theory, cultural hegemony is the means to class dominance. In his view, a new communist man had to be created through a changed culture before any political revolution was possible. This led to a focus on the efforts of intellectuals in the fields of education and media. George Lukács believed that for a new Marxist culture to emerge, the existing culture must be destroyed, he said. I saw the revolutionary destruction of society as the one and only solution to the cultural contradictions of the epoch. Such a worldwide overturning of values cannot take place without the annihilation of the old values and the creation of new ones by revolutionaries. In 1923, Lukács and the other Marxist intellectuals associated with the Communist Party in Germany founded the Institute of Social Research at Frankfurt University in Frankfurt, Germany. The institute, which became known as the Frankfurt School, was modeled after the Marx-Engels Institute in Moscow in 1933. When the Nazis came to power in Germany, the members of the Frankfurt School fled. Most of them came to the United States, and many became influential in American universities. And they also, many of them went to Hollywood. And the Frankfurt School's studies combined Marxist analysis with Freudian psychoanalysis to form the basis of what became known as critical theory. Now, critical theory was essentially destructive criticism of the main elements of Western culture, including Christianity, capitalism, authority, the family, patriarchy, hierarchy, morality, tradition, sexual restraint, loyalty, patriotism, nationalism, heredity, ethnocentrism, convention, and conservatism. Does this all sound familiar? Yeah, doesn't it? Critical theorists recognized that traditional beliefs in the existing social structure would have to be destroyed and then replaced with a new thinking that would become as much a part of elementary consciousness as the old one had been. Their theories took hold in the tumultuous 1960s when the Vietnam War opened a Pandora's box of re-evaluation and revolution. The student radicals of the era were strongly influenced by revolutionary ideas, among them those of Herbert Marcuse, a member of the Frankfurt School, who preached the great refusal, a rejection of all basic Western concepts, and an embrace of sexual liberation, and the merits of feminist and black revolutions. And his primary thesis was that university students, ghetto blacks, and the alienated, and the antisocial, and the third world could take the place of the proletariat in the coming communist revolution. Marcuse may be the most important member of the Frankfurt School in terms of the origin of political correctness, because he was the critical link to the counterculture of the 1960s. His objective was clear. One can rightfully speak of a cultural revolution, and since the protest is directed toward the whole cultural establishment, including morality of the existing society. When addressing the general public, contemporary advocates of political correctness, or cultural Marxism, as it might just as easily be called, present their beliefs with appealing simplicity as merely a commitment to being sensitive to other people and embracing values such as tolerance and diversity. The reality is different. Political correctness is the use of culture as a sharp weapon to enforce new forms and to stigmatize those who dissent from the new dispensation, ties those who insist on values that will impede the new PC regime, free speech, and free and objective intellectual inquiry. Now, that is political correctness. And I would like to also hear, because we have some time, plenty of time left, I'd like to back some of this up with a reference to a book called Controlling the Human Mind, The Technologies of Political Control, or Tools for Peak Performance, by Dr. Nick Begich. And Nick Begich is an American Indian from Alaska who has a PhD, and he's the son of an Alaskan congressman, and he's an expert on mind control. And this book that he has, Controlling the Human Mind, it came out, it was published in 2006. And this book documents a great deal of what we've been referring to, electronic mind control, and some of the effects, and it even mentions, which, and I was kind of surprised to find this out, because I've read, being quite interested in hypnosis, I read George Easterbrook's books, and to find out that George Easterbrook, the American hypnotist, George Easterbrook, is originally the originator of the Manchurian Candidate concept. I thought that came from the Pavlov Institute. But apparently Easterbrook, according to what Nick Begich has in here, Easterbrook originally developed the concept, and actually back before World War II. And I'll read you about that in a minute. But let's talk about the actual electronic targeting devices. On page 48, we have a little chapter called the Beam Team. And I'll read from that. There have been stories that have been made public that describe some of the exotic uses and misuses of these technologies. From the 1960s through the 1970s, there were news and intelligence reports of microwave beams being directed at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. There are some indications that beaming of the embassy was also conducted as late as 1983. This beaming has been the subject of much speculation over the years. The government has not released the full story, and for the most part, it remains classified. Speculated effects of the radiation included health impairment and mind manipulation. Beginning in 1965, the government tested embassy personnel for genetic damage, which may have been caused by the microwave beaming. At the same time, they launched Operation Pandora, where monkeys were exposed to the same type of signals in order to measure the effects. I wonder what the anti-vivisectionists think of that. While government representatives have maintained that there were no ill effects from the microwaves, the result of the embassy personnel testing in Pandora remained classified. And even though the impact of Russian microwave radiation is unclear, it turns out that there may very well have been some effect. When Dr. Gottlieb, the MKUltra program director for CIA, testified to the United States Congress, he said that when President Nixon went to the USSR in 1971, members of his party showed abnormal behavior, including crying and depression. The spy community already knew that the Soviets had developed microwave beaming technologies which could affect mind, memory, and health. Soviet research had already shown that it was also possible to create hallucinations and significant perceptual changes in people. The CIA's use of mind-altering technologies is not new. Under MKUltra, the CIA conducted memory experiments on thousands of unknowing people across the United States in 180 hospitals, research centers, and prisons. The CIA used LSD and other drugs, brainwashing, sensory deprivation, hypnosis, and many other mind control techniques until 1976, when the United States Senate investigated these practices. It appears the names of these programs and their approaches changed over the years, but the programs have continued. Meanwhile, the Soviets had moved away, way ahead of the United States in their development of mind war technologies. They had perfected a device called the LIDA, L-I-D-A, a machine that produced an extremely low frequency, ELF, E-L-F, and pulsing field. And LIDA was used to put prisoners of war into a trance so that secrets could be extracted from them more readily. And as mentioned later, the device was tested by Dr. Ross Adley in the United States at the Loma Linda VA hospital. The Soviets went on to discover that by slight manipulation, by reversing brain polarity, that sounds kind of shaver-like, by passing very low voltage current through the front of the brain to the back, they could induce deep sleep. Mounting evidence also indicated that they may have perfected telepathic hypnosis, which could be deployed from hundreds of miles away from the target person. Now, let me just mention something following up on that. I think it was about a year and a half ago, a Navy sailor who was in a Navy hospital back east, postal, if you will, and went prowling around the hospital shooting people. on a rampage, and his shotgun that he was using, he had engraved on it with an electric pencil. He had engraved my ELF weapon, my ELF weapon. And he claimed himself that he had been a subject of experiments in mind control. That I would like to let's see here. I should have dog-eared this. I'm trying to find the Esther Brooks and the Manchurian Candidate here. But apparently, Esther Brooks, very famous American hypnotist. Yeah, here it is, I think. Yeah. The Manchurian Candidate. The idea of a Manchurian Candidate, I think you're all familiar with a Manchurian Candidate is a person who has been usually a prisoner of war, who's been brainwashed and programmed to when he returns to his native land, when he's repatriated, he will be a sleeper assassin. You know, in other words, you've made him into a sleeper agent, terrorist, or a hitman, an assassin. Now, the idea of a Manchurian Candidate being created can be traced back to the research of Dr. George Estabrooks, who worked in Prince's lab at Harvard University in the 1920s. He believed that one could use hypnosis to create a multiple personality for use in developing a super spy. And he pushed the idea on the U.S. military throughout the 1920s without success. However, after an incident in the Soviet Union, the research in his area became of interest to the military. Estabrooks' work was classified by the mid-1930s. Apparently, in his archives, it was noted that he stopped publishing on these subjects at that time. A review of the work of his mentor, Morton Prince, is interesting as it appears in the index of the Library of Congress. The 569-page book, Dissection of a Personality by Morton Prince, published in 1906, remains a classic in psychology. Prince also wrote an earlier book in 1885 called The Nature of Mind and Human Automatism, Estabrooks. Estabrooks' interest was focused on the idea that hypnosis could be used for creating the perfect spy. And by 1963, he believed that he could create a multiple personality and use them as he saw fit. He said, "This is not science fiction, it is fact. I have done it." The Manchurian Candidate could be created. In the years since, there have been many claims by people that they were used in experiments by our government, where their personalities were fractured in this way. It is difficult to prove, but what is clear is human victims were created in these various programs. Estabrooks died in 1973, just before the congressional hearings on the CIA use of mind control were held. He would have likely been one of the experts called in the field. His writings during the Cold War were all very revealing, including his rational for why, when, and where controlling a person through hypnosis could be justified. Revealing his thoughts in his published works, he attempted to rationalize his research with unwitting subjects. He deliberately created multiple personalities, fracturing personalities through induced trauma, and then reprogramming people. All of these ideas were discussed in two of his most important books, Hypnotism in 1943 and The Future of the Human Mind in 1961. The idea that there were military uses revealed in a chapter in Hypnotism called the Hypnotism in Warfare, as was his rationale for justified research and the use of these technologies. He also believed that LSD was useful in researching the human mind. LSD would later be used in mind control programs with the CIA. Not successfully, of course. But this gives us a very good idea of the origin of the whole Manchurian Candidate principle. By the way, the film recently, the Manchurian Candidate film, which came out back the first version of it was back in the 1970s, and of course it supposedly took place during the Korean War, and that film starred Frank Sinatra and Janet Leigh, and it's been recently remade. The original is much, much better than the remake. In the remake, they use an implant instead of hypnotic, and that's not the original idea at all. The only other thing I would like to mention about this mind control, electronic mind control, is that it is in a sense cumulative, and this is in the case of the political correctness, this is a cumulative version of it, and we are literally brainwashed by the content of our media, of our mass media, and our films and television, and the way the news is spun, and of course the use of neurolinguistics. By the way, I mentioned neurolinguistics as part of the brainwashing technique, and I'll give you another example of that. Neurolinguistics. Yeah, you can. In neurolinguistics, you learn that if you wish to get someone to do something, you ask them three times to do it. And the first time, when they can refuse the first time. The second time, the neurolinguistics researchers found out that the human mind, when it's faced with making decisions, that it doesn't like to make any more than it doesn't want to have any more than three choices, and it can't handle any more than three choices. So the example that's used in this is when the guy that has the date with the girl and he wants to get her to come into his apartment, and he says, and she's at the door, and he says, come in, take your coat off and sit down. So she comes in, because that she didn't want to handle, she can't handle any more than three, so she's got three things that she's been told to do. He says, come in, take your coat off, and sit down. So she comes in, she takes her coat off, and then she decides whether or not she's going to sit down. So what he's done is it's like a magician forcing cards on you. You know, the magician uses, in fact, I think that's probably where the neurolinguistics people, where they learned it, was probably from magicians, because this is like the forced card. You know, pick a card, any card. And the neurolinguistics I remember there's a very, very good example of it in a film by none other than Orson Welles. And the film is called Black Magic, an appropriate title. And Orson Welles plays Cagliostro. And this is one of the most powerful scenes of instant mesmerism, because back when hypnosis got started, these mesmerists, stage mesmerists, were phenomenal. These people were literally phenomenal. They could walk out on the stage and take someone and just point their finger at them and paralyze them, you know, with their hand and their eyes. It was like old Bela Lugosi, you know, with his hands. And they had a tremendous ability to do this, partly based upon the fact that people thought they could do it. There was a power of suggestion when someone comes walking out walking to you, looking you right in the eye, and he says, "Sleep," and in a very commanding sort of way, and you know he's a hypnotist. Here he is wearing a tuxedo and a cape and all of this, and you know he's a hypnotist, so he already has that aura about him, and your power of suggestion. So part of it was that, but there was more to it than that. These original mesmerists, they had something that hypnotists today wish they had. Of course, old Milton Erickson had it. And you know, you never want to shake hands with Milton Erickson. If you shook hands with him, he had you. His colleagues didn't even want to shake hands with him. Now even at cocktail parties, Wells did in this film is that he was invited to the Royal Palace, and the aristocrats wanted to make fun of him, so they dressed up as poor cripples and poor beggars and cripples, and they all pretended that they were afflicted with various they were limping and they were one of them had palsy and one of them was down on all fours. They were all acting as if they were afflicted. And they demanded to be cured because Cagliostro was making a reputation as a healer around Paris. So Wells was very impressively dressed, you know, with this costume. The magician looked like the magician out of a Lindsay painting, and he was very impressively dressed, and he walked over to one of these aristocrats who was shaking like a leaf, and he said, "If I can heal, I can also afflict." He says, "What is your affliction?" "Palsy." "Yes, you have palsy, don't you?" "Yes, you do. You have palsy." He can't stop. He says, "You can't stop." And then somebody else, he gets him down, and he can't walk. And he does this by the use of three. 1, 2, 3. He says, "What was your affliction?" And he uses, you can't, "You're lame, you can't walk, you can't," you know. The effect is tremendous because Wells, with his own dynamic personality, he gives you the impression, as an actor, he gives you the impression that he has this mesmeristic power, the way the scene is done. But neurolinguistics is used by people, you know, with less mesmeristic and hypnotic power than that. It's used in our programming, in our political arguments, and it's used over and over again in this media brainwashing. Next week, the end of, we'll wrap this one up here. Now, to accept the fact that we live in an ocean of radiation. Now, I know Art Kunkin likes to mention this in relation to his, to his irradiated apples. And he says, we live in an ocean of radiation. Radio waves, microwaves, waves in all frequencies pass through our bodies and our brains constantly. Now, to assume that these waves and the data they carry do not register and affect us would be very unwise. In fact, we should probably suspect electronic mind control as the primary agent in such incidents as mass shootings and destructive riots. Remember the shooter in the Navy hospital with the shotgun? This is my elf weapon. Now, Frank Herbert's Nightmare Blues strangely resonates in today's political Halloween season. In 1939, Orson Welles broadcast his version of H.G. Wells' Mars Invasion on Halloween. So Nightmare Blues is our Halloween offering. Boo. Now, next week, we're going to get along the same line. We're going to have present an essay on how the cultural Marxists hijacked Christianity, and that should be quite interesting. So next week, the hijacking of Christianity, and until then, good magic.